So we're looking at 6:10, 1 to 10, and we've been doing this. We're going to do this for 3 weeks. Next, George is finishing up with sowing and reaping. But the actual nice thing for me is my verses are all in the chunk at the beginning. So I'm just going to read those, and the other people can speak about the other ones. Brothers and sisters, if someone is caught in sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently. But watch yourself, or you may also be tempted. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks they are something when they are not, they deceive themselves. Each one should test their own actions. Then they can take pride in themselves alone without comparing themselves to someone else. For each one should carry their own load. Now, as I said, this is the series of Galatians for me is the last sermon, but it's actually, Galatians is one of the first, indeed, I believe in my memory, the first book that I preached from when I was 17 in Lawn Community Church in Swindon. I don't even think the church exists anymore, but the Lawn Community still exists there, a suburb around Swindon. And when I was, I brought up in a Christian family. At 4 years old, I gave my life to God, and I said to my mum, I'm going to be a preacher one day. I pointed to the man who gave the word, and I said, I'm going to be like him. And here I am. But at 15, I recommitted my life to God. And in the years of 15, 16, 17, I was part of this church, and I really rekindled my faith and grew in that. And the book of Galatians was of particular importance to me. I think Galatians is a great book for everyone, but it's a great appeal for teenager because it's passionate, it's vigorous, and it's quite clear. It's quite kind of black and white, and it's a relatively simple book. You can kind of work through it. And it really, it caught me at that point. And therefore, it's a real excitement to come back to this book for me. And in those years, as I started, 15, 16, 17 in Swindon, and then I went on to Chichester, Carlisle, and then I went to University in Aberdeen, I began to really experience a call and a passion about God's church. And I began taking more and more responsibility in leadership, in preaching, in worship leading, and all sorts of things. I used to lead worship. Can you believe it? Bless those who responded, who received that ministry. But all those sort of things. And over those years and since then, I got encaptured, kind of just embraced and encouraged and blown away by the teaching of what the church might be. And just so passionate about seeing God's church grow and develop in strength and going out and sharing the good news with all they might encounter. Over the years, I encountered different thinkers and biblical books and ideas, obviously. People like Bill Hybels, the famous lines like, the local church is the hope of the world. You might have heard that. And Bill Hybels also, the biblically functioning community. If you're in charismatic circles, you might talk about the Acts 2 community, that idea of this community from the book of Acts, where the community are coming together, praying, meeting in the temple courts, sharing everything and sharing the gospel and seeing great transformation in the city of Jerusalem. More recently, I heard this one, the local church is God's plan A, B, and C, and there is no other plan. In the scriptures, you obviously see loads of pictures of the power of the church and its role in God's plan, the bride of Christ being possibly the most famous one. But over the years, I've also experienced, so I got that, heard about that. I also experienced some other things in church, the sort of the underside of it. I experienced difficulty. I experienced difficult people. I experienced frustration. I experienced bad decisions. I experienced incompetence, frustration, hypocrisy. Two of my great mentors in my faith both had extramarital affairs, hypocrisy in the church. That's not to judge them because we all are struggling with sin, but sadness, disillusionment, disappointment as well. Well, I'm sure we can all relate in lesser or greater ways to both the highs and the lows of being in the church. But in this, the reality of both these extremes, we have some different choices. And these are some of the things I've observed in myself and I've observed in others. And to put it really simply, there's sort of maybe three or four different ways we can respond. Are we on, David? So I think I'm on here. Yes, we are. No one. Yes, we are. Yes. Brilliant. But we're not going forward. Oh, yes, we're going forward. That's when. You've got to press, I was pressing the volume button rather than the slide button. That's gonna make a difference. The first one is in the light of this difference, in the light of this discouragement, that people slip out. People who are a member of the community. They used to come to church every week, used to be part of the community. And then they start coming every other week, and they start coming every month. More, it's just not about attendance, actually, as we know. It's about a heart thing. But their desire is to kind of just slip away and notice, if I can kind of just slowly exit, no one will really notice. But it's a sort of silent one. The next one is the exact opposite. And this is what I like to call crashing out. Crashing out. The frustrations of church life, the difficulties of us, of it, causes us to crash out of the community. We want to go with the big as much explosion and passion and frustration. And I have to say, in some cases, not unjustified. It's not the church. I'm not defending the church in its perfection. Sometimes justified. But the heart of it is to go, I'm going to cause as much of a noise and a splash as I possibly can, and everyone's going to not mark my passing. The crash out. But the one I think that's probably the most sort of common, and the one I suppose I relate to more often, not as a matter of righteousness, because I'm just not a very conflicty type person, is this one. We sign out. We sign out. And actually, we can sign out without ever physically leaving the meeting or the building or the community. And so we decide that we're just going to disengage. We'll still come to church. In fact, we might come on Sunday. We might be part of a life group. We might go to some prayer meetings. But fundamentally, at a spirit and heart level, on a relational level, with the community around, we sign out in the face of difficulties, in the face of challenge, in the face of different things, rather than try and work those things through. We just kind of just withdraw silently. And the incredible thing is you can sign out at any level of involvement in church. I've been in church leadership, on staff teams, and I have to admit, I've signed out. I've gone through the motions. I've just gone, you know what, this is just too hard. But I just rocked up, did the best I could. But fundamentally, tragically, there's been points when I've signed out the community. It just seemed the easier option. But is there another way? And I believe there is. And I believe that we can find that other way as we look in Galatians. And I think that a great guide for us in this process, this living in the realities of the glory and the grime of church, is Paul. As we look at Galatians, his first letter. Now, we've got to remember that Paul is the greatest theologian on the issue of the church. Now, Jesus is the foundation of our church. But God, by his wisdom and spirit, chose Paul to be his apostle to the early church. Paul is the basis on which most of our ideas about what the church, how it functions, the theology of it, all those things are based upon. He is this apostle of the church, and through his letters, we have a revelation of the picture of the church. And so Paul is the one who develops the idea of the theology of the church. He fundamentally, from the base of his being to the top of his being, believes in the power and the role of the church. He speaks about the fact that the sons, that nature, the universe itself, is crying out for the revelation of the sons of God. He fundamentally believes that the church's role is somehow universal. Am I all right, Tim? Oh, I'm back on again. No, maybe I hadn't. Maybe it's fine. Universal in impact. And so if you come across his first letters, the first letter we've got. Now, he might have written some more letters, but we don't have those letters. But the first letter, we think, Galatians is probably his oldest letter. You would meet a fresh-eyed, bright-eyed, happy-go-lucky, optimistic man about his experience and theology of church. But if you've been with us through the series in Galatians, we know that isn't the case. He is optimistic about the church, but he's already experienced profound challenge as being part of the community. We read in his biography that the whole issue that's circling around Galatians about what it means to be part of the people of God and whether circumcision, the Jewish law, is essential to be part of the people of God. He has fallen out with possibly one of his best mates, Barnabas. He's fallen out with Peter, who is the rock on which the church was built, Jesus said. He's fallen out with he certainly caused a big explosion in his home community church, the church in Antioch. Paul has already experienced the grime, and he also believes in the glory of church. And so he's got something for us to say. And I think this passage today is really helpful in him speaking to the Galatian church in the midst of their difficulties. Now, we all have difficulties. And what struck me about the Galatian church is, you know, in church, there's always disagreements, different things, different opinions, all these sort of things. But Paul's trying to find a way forward. But in Galatians, right, the nature of the disagreement has been so high that some people have had penis alteration operations to make their point. Like, with physically carrying the scars of this disagreement inside the church. You can't kind of get more fundamental. And Paul is trying to forge a way forward for this community. I mean, I've never been in a church where that's been a problem, you know, thankfully. But Paul's trying to find a way forward for this community. And that's what we're going to look at today. So I want to just start here at the beginning. We'll just go very briefly through this passage as we look at the different highlights. The first thing is, in verse 1, brothers and sisters. Now, the good Bishop Lightfoot reminded me that brothers and sisters is the first word in the passage and the last word in this chapter. So the first word in this chapter and the last word, if you discount amen. Brothers and sisters, or as it would be in Greek, brethren. And the last word in chapter 6 is also brethren, brothers and sisters. This chapter is for the community. It's a chapter that helps a community forge a way forward. Now, I didn't speak to Bishop Lightfoot. He actually died 200 years ago, or 120 years ago. I read one of his books, or I read someone quoting one of his books. I've not even done that much research. You'd be pleased to know. But I thought it's a great little insight in Paul's. Paul is a genius in terms of his creation and his construction of his arguments. And these words and these structures are actually significant, I believe. So, brothers and sisters, so Paul's got this great picture of the church. How does he start out? He says this, if someone is caught in sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently. Paul's opening gambit for this community is this. There's going to be sin in the community. That's reality. There is going to be sin. There is brokenness. There is weakness in this community. And if you're going to go forward, you're going to be all the glorious picture of what the church is going to be. You're going to have to work in this context. There's going to be sin in the community. I'm going to put that down because we don't use it anymore. And then Paul explains how we should restore these people. It's not to reject them, but to restore these people. And explains how we might do that with grace and sensitivity. He warns, but watch yourself, or you too also may be tempted. Verse 2. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. Now, George, when he planned this, he said we entitled different sermons. We had doing good last week, and he said this was burdens and loads. And that's going to be the pivot on what this sermon's talked about. These two words, burdens and loads. So he says, carry each other burdens. Now, what does Paul mean by burdens? Now, in Greek, the idea of burdens, the word burden here, is a heavy load that you have to carry from one place to another place. Okay? So it's a heavy load. But the Greek, the phrase, the word that's been used here, has in its connotation, it's connected to the idea that this load might be something that is punishing, that is destructive, indeed may destroy you. So the use of the word, of this word burdens, is that it might be a burden that might destroy you. So, Paul, what is his burdens that Paul's talking about? Well, the verse before talks about sin. So some of the burdens that Paul's talking about is the fact we have to carry each other's burdens. We're carrying each other's mistakes, our sinfulness, our weaknesses. We're people that are in progress, aren't we? We're not finished works, any of us. All of us are people in progress. And if we're going to live with each other, we have to carry each other's burdens to work with each other as we are people in progress. Burdens, burdens are basically anything that might crush someone. So we might think of health issues. We might think of suffering. We might think of bereavement. We might think of physical or mental health. But really, you could carry on defining what a burden might be in every context, in every moment, in different ways. But fundamentally, we must carry and share the things that might crush and destroy individuals or the community. That's what Paul is calling this community to do. We're going to circle around to this verse as we come and conclude this passage, but I want to move on. Paul carries on. If anyone thinks they are something when they are not, they deceive themselves. Each one should test their own actions. then they can take pride in themselves alone without comparing themselves to someone else. Here, Paul speaks to the poison of judgment and comparison. He says, guys, judging others and comparing ourselves incorrectly is a poison that will destroy both the individuals and the community as a whole. You place yourself under God, your responsibilities. Now, as I said at the beginning, I'm a believer called to preach and to share the word. I mean, one of my callings. But there's other people who have that same calling. Most No, we're okay. Billy Graham. Now, if I was to sit and compare my ministry to Billy Graham's, it would be a crushing burden, wouldn't it? But it's not to say that God might one day say, I want you to have that ministry. You can't discount that. But up to this time, I've not been given the opportunity or the call to carry on a ministry like Billy Graham's. When I meet Jesus, I'm responsible for how I use my gifts and my talents and the opportunities in my time to use what I had. We need to come in front of God in humility and in wisdom and understand ourselves, our own calling, and respond in like ways. But particularly the roles of judging others and comparing ourselves to others in the community or in the church at wide is a poison that we must be careful, not a road we can't go down, otherwise it will destroy us. And then lastly, it says this, for no one should carry their own load. Now, this passage has been used by some as an example of contradictions in the scripture. And in fairness, the King James Version, there was an apparent complete contradiction. Because in their wisdom, the translators of the King James Version, and great people I'm sure they were, translated both these Greek words, load and burden, they're different Greek words, as burden. So it says this in the King James. Carry each other's burdens, and then three verses later, for each one should carry their own burden. So it appeared to be a direct contradiction. But it's not. The words in Greek have a specific meaning that help us understand what this is talking about. I think we do actually relate to this, the wisdom of this, anyway, just intrinsically, but when we go a little bit deeper, I think we can understand even more. The idea here, the word in Greek, is that of a load or a pack. And so this same word would be used of a Roman soldier's pack. A soldier would carry a pack. Now, I said the burden was carried from A to B. Now, the load or the pack that you carry about all the time. The soldier, there's not a day he doesn't carry his pack. Every day of marching, he picks up his pack and he walks. Now, the pack for the soldier has everything that he needs to sustain him in his life. So it's maybe his mementos, his personal things, but it's the things he'd been given for the army as well, his wineskin, his cup. I don't know much about what Roman soldiers carried. I didn't do that much research. You can imagine. The point is this. If you shared a burden with someone, they would be delighted to share the burden. If you stole a soldier's pack, they'd be furious because the pack was the thing that would sustain them through life. So I think what Paul's saying here is the load that we're called to carry are the things that we're responsible for in life. So that might be things of our own health, our hygiene, the people we're responsible for, our finances, our jobs, all these sort of things. These are things that sustain us through life. Now, I do recognize that sometimes loads can become burdens. Let's take the one portion, for example, finances. Sometimes, through no fault of our own, our finances get out of control and we fall into debt. Helene spoke powerfully recently about her testimony of that. Sometimes, as I say, no fault of our own. Maybe sometimes it is fault of our own, but it doesn't matter. Sometimes a load that we can carry becomes a burden that can crush you. And that's why we support CAP. That is an organization that comes in to support people when a load becomes a crushing burden. And so I recognize that these loads sometimes become burdens. So just to distinguish that, I think is helpful for us. The other thing that really struck me is that if you ever encounter a community which says, you know what, we'll share your burdens and you know, we'll also take your load. You don't need to worry about your finances, your children. You don't need to have a job. You know what that community is? That community is a cult. And that is the appeal of cults. They do literally say that. You give us all your money and we'll take away all these things. And it's tremendously appealing for broken people because literally they don't have to think about anything. But that's a definition of a cult. And so again, Paul's just warning people. You've got to be responsible for the things that sustain you in life. This is a sign of a healthy community. And I think it's just wonderful, the sort of earthy wisdom that Paul provides for us as we work through forward as a community. But I want to conclude by looking at this passage by saying this. I think one of the great temptations at this time, maybe more so than in the past, but I'm sure for Christians throughout history, is this. If only I could get rid of all the nonsense of church and relationships and commitments and rotas. If I could get rid of all that stuff, I could really worship Jesus. It would just be me and Jesus. And there is an appeal. I can see the sort of half wisdom in it. If we could just get rid of all this stuff, because sometimes just church is just full of some stuff you think, does it really matter? But if we get rid of all this stuff, then it could just be me and Jesus. And wouldn't that be what it's all about? But Paul, I would suggest, says something very different. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. The carrying of each other's burdens, the sharing of these loads, these things of life. This is how you fulfill the law of Christ. The law might be understood another way by saying the way of Christ. If you want to follow him, if you want to walk in his footsteps, then the way of Christ is in the midst of this community of faith. I fundamentally believe that Jesus didn't just choose the disciples as a method of leadership training for the church. I believe that Jesus, in his fullness, in his divinity and his humanity, he needed the disciples too. He needed to walk with the community. And without walking with that community, he could not fulfill the call that was on his life. If that is the case for Jesus, then how much more for us? The way of Christ is worked out in the midst of living with some of the frustrations and the difficult, the grime and the glory of being in the church.